Today on the show, conservative Americans convene in Hungary, Washington sends troops to Somalia, and foreign firms help offset the U.S. shortage of baby formula. But there's a problem.
Customs has been seizing European baby formula shipments that are arriving in the United States because they're technically illegal.
Also today, we meet the U.S. Special Envoy for International LGBTQI plus rights. Jessica Stern says her message can spread in powerful ways.
When countries show leadership on these issues, it's infectious.
I'm Marco Werman, and Australian voters head to the polls this weekend with a lot less drama than America's Tuesday rituals.
The Australian electoral system is beautifully dull because everything basically works.
What makes Australia's beautiful bureaucracy the envy of many? Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us today. Even if you don't have a tiny bundle of joy in your home, you've probably heard by now about the baby formula shortage in the U.S.
There was nothing left on the entire shelf. I took a picture and sent it home. And I was like,
parents are turning to milk banks and to social media, searching for formula to swap or
to buy. It's scary. I mean, it's super scary. It's the only thing she can eat.
Now some international firms are trying to make up the difference by shipping supplies of formula to the U.S., but easier said than done. We reached out to Scott Lincecum to explain why. He's the Director of General Economics and Trade for the Cato Institute. I asked him for the backstory of what's causing the shortage.
Well, you got to start with the pandemic. It seems we always start with the pandemic, right? Mm. There's no doubt that, like all sorts of other industries, global supply chains and domestic supply chains, the pandemic wreaked havoc with the infant formula industry. That then was compounded by the recall in Michigan and an Abbott Nutrition factory in Michigan, which constitute a lot of our domestic supply. But turns out when you dig a little deeper, the biggest issues are on the trade side. It turns out that we have very high tariffs on all types of infant formula manufactured abroad, including from places like Europe or trading partners in New Zealand, which is another large dairy producer. Not only do we have these normal tariffs, but the Trump administration during the NAFTA renegotiation actually went out and made restrictions on Canadian infant formula even more onerous, even more restrictive. And that was done because American dairy farmers were concerned about Chinese investments in Canadian capacity causing additional competition in the U.S. market in infant formula and other products.
So I want to get back to trade policy in a moment, but we're looking right now at big international firms like Nestle in Switzerland. Companies in the UK and the Netherlands are flying additional shipments of formula to the US. Is that going to solve the shortage?
I doubt it, simply because we're talking about such a big chunk of supply being offline. The United States does not traditionally import baby formula. About 98% of all baby formula consumed in the United States is made domestically. And so there aren't the sales and distribution channels set up. And very importantly, there aren't the FDA requirements that are being met by a lot of formula that's made abroad, including in very, you know, safe and healthy places like the European Union, which is the world's largest producer and exporter of baby formula.
Right. I mean, those FDA requirements means that a lot of baby formula that comes out of Europe is actually illegal in this country. Why is that? What's going on?
The problem here is that we have an additional wall of FDA regulation that requires that any product sold in the United States be registered, that it meets various labeling and nutritional requirements, that the scooper be a certain size, that facilities abroad agree to be inspected by the FDA, and on and on and on. And so very few manufacturers abroad have agreed to do this. And even though there is significant demand for European baby formula in the United States, as a result, Customs has been seizing European baby formula shipments that are arriving in the United States because they're technically illegal. You know, a lot of the products made in Germany don't have labels in English. And that alone makes these products subject to seizure at the border. So this, again, it creates essentially a wall around the United States, and really a two-level wall with the tariffs and then the FDA restrictions. And very few companies are going to want to go through the effort to target the U.S. market, particularly because we are not a really active and growing market. You know, we have slowing demographics, we're getting older, and foreign manufacturers are just simply going to not go through the time and effort to do that.
So, Scott, how soon do you think this crisis will ease up? And should parents across the U.S. be counting on foreign formula?
If you listen to the manufacturers themselves, it looks like we're going to be with this through most of the summer, you know, maybe July or even into August. And look, European formula is globally exported. The Europeans have a sterling regulatory reputation. And if when push comes to shove, if parents need to find alternatives, I think that should be available to them. They should be able to make that decision themselves and not simply have the FDA blocking those transactions.
Scott Lincecome is the Director of General Economics and Trade for the Cato Institute. Thank you very much for explaining this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
After a year of delay, Somalia's president is finally taking office. Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud will lead the country. This will be his second time serving as president. One of the biggest challenges his government now faces is security. This week, the U.S. announced that it will be sending American troops back to Somalia to help. The world's Africa correspondent Halima Gakandi reports.
President Joe Biden has signed off on a plan to send U.S. troops back to Somalia. This would reestablish a small U.S. military presence there. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre explained why.
The decision to reintroduce a small but persistent presence was made first and foremost to maximize the safety and effectiveness of our force and enable them to provide better support of our partners.
Former President Donald Trump ordered hundreds of U.S. troops to pull out of Somalia in January 2021. Omar Mahmoud is with the International Crisis Group.
I view that as being done more for domestic political reasons in terms of ending these sort of forever wars. But those troops essentially went to the region. They went to Kenya and Djibouti.
From there, U.S. forces continued to conduct operations inside Somalia. For years, American troops have worked with international partners to fight al-Shabaab, the Somali group affiliated with al-Qaeda. General Stephen Townsend, head of the U.S. Africa Command, says extremist groups are still a big problem in the region.
Are among the world's fastest growing, wealthiest, and deadliest terrorist groups. And remain grave and growing threats that aspire to kill Americans, both there and in our homeland.
In 2020, Shabaab fighters attacked a military camp used by Kenyan and U.S. troops in Kenya, killing three Americans. The U.S. has been training Somali special forces to counter the group. Omar Mahmoud, the analyst, says the Trump decision to reposition U.S. troops has put that training effort at a disadvantage.
So I think it impacted that because they weren't there day to day on the ground.
But Mahmoud says there is still this question, what is the ultimate endgame of the U.S. military presence in Somalia? Over the years, a lot of financial and military resources from the international community have gone towards fighting al-Shabaab. But today, the group still holds large swaths of land in rural central and southern Somalia.
So we have to take this into consideration. Yes, they are an actor that engages in terrorist violence as well, but they are also a governing actor that operates on the ground, that has relationships, that has control in areas where the federal government just hasn't been able to penetrate.
Mahmoud says a military defeat of al-Shabaab might not be possible. Somalia's government will need to consider other options, but he says the leadership has been too distracted by politics.
The environment in Somalia is so divisive. It's become so polarized. This election has exacerbated that. And without focusing on that first, I think it's going to be very hard to make progress on other fronts.
In a statement, Somalia's newly elected president said he appreciates President Biden's move to redeploy American troops. He called the U.S. a reliable partner in the country's quest for stability and fight against terrorism. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
The largest and most influential gathering of American conservatives is convening this week. It is the annual Conservative Political Action Conference, better known as CPAC. And this year, it's happening in Hungary, the first time the conference is taking place in Europe. Hungary's nationalist leader, Prime Minister Viktor Orban, will be the keynote speaker. We wanted to know why CPAC is taking place in Hungary. For that, we turned to Kaz Muda, who researches populism and the radical right at the University of Georgia.
Well, the leader of Hungary, Viktor Orban, who has been reelected yet again, has invested a lot of money over the last years to make his country kind of the center of what he calls conservative, but is increasingly far right activity, not just in Europe, but around the globe. And one of the key reasons why he recently has invested a lot in the Anglosphere, both British and American, is that his position within the EU has become more marginalized. And so he hopes to build up broader support in the US for when the Republicans come back to power and he has a strong ally that he can balance then to the EU.
Well, we saw the provocative Tucker Carlson go on his own mission to Hungary. What do some American conservatives see in Viktor Orban? What does he symbolize?
Well, first of all, he symbolizes a leader who stands up against what most of the American Republicans consider the left or liberals, against immigration, against what they call gender ideology, or recently Orban called it gender madness, against so-called political correctness. So in terms of the culture wars, Orban is really on their side. And on top of that, he is, of course, very successful, having been reelected several times since 2010.
And other notable political figures in attendance at CPAC this year in Hungary? I mean, who's going and what do they represent?
Generally, there are people from the European Conservatives and Reformist, which is a conservative slash far right group in the European Parliament that was founded by the British Conservatives. There will be leaders from far-right parties in Europe, including the leader of the Flemish Interest in Belgium. So it's a mix of politicians from far-right parties and from parties that used to be conservative and have radicalized since.
Yeah, and at the center of the discussion in Hungary is the controversial Great Replacement ideology, the belief in a liberal plot to dilute white populations in Europe and the U.S. What do Orban and American conservatives share in common with that?
Well, they both believe in it, as has been very clear over the last weeks in the U.S. with various high-ranking politicians expressing the Great Replacement theory. But so did Viktor Orban in his first speech of his new term as prime minister, which was just days after the Buffalo massacre. And he almost literally referred to the Great Replacement theory. And so for Orban, this has been the key ideology since the so-called refugee crisis of 2015-2016, an ideology that he uses to kind of become the central leader in opposition to this nefast plan of the left in Europe.
So interestingly, your Twitter bio says, "I used to study the politics of the margins. Now I study the politics of the mainstream." Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so I'm first and foremost a scholar of the far right, of nativism, authoritarianism, and populism. And when I started studying that in the late 1980s, early 1990s, these parties were single-digit parties that were mostly excluded from power, even from media debates in many countries. Today, both these actors, but particularly their ideas, are in the political mainstream. They're either shared or propagated by mainstream parties or by radical right parties that are now defining the mainstream, like Viktor Orban in Hungary.
Kaius Muda is a political scientist at the University of Georgia and a leading expert on populism and the radical right, speaking with us about the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, this year taking place in Hungary. Kaius Muda, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In his first month in office, President Biden committed to advancing LGBTQ rights at home and abroad. One thing he did to abide by that commitment was appointing Jessica Stern as the U.S. Special Envoy for International LGBTQI+ Rights. In her first extended interview since starting at the State Department last fall, Special Envoy Stern spoke with The World's Bianca Hillier. Before we get into your conversation, Bianca, give us some background on Stern. Where was she and what was she doing before the State Department?
She spent 10 years leading Outright Action International, which is a global human rights organization. There, she helped LGBTQ groups around the world get off the ground and advocate for themselves. And she was also key in getting the UN to appoint an independent expert on sexual orientation and gender identity, which was seen as a major accomplishment. So she's been in this space for a long time.
So now that she's at the State Department, remind us of the scope of Special Envoy Stern's work and the purpose of this position.
Yeah, the mandate is really wide-ranging. So at the State Department, Jessica Stern sets policy priorities for the U.S. and meets with other governments about best practices they're enforcing. And she also acts as a kind of in-house expert for other people at the State Department so that LGBTQ rights are integrated into all levels of U.S. foreign policy.
So, I mean, that's a lot for one person. Is this the first position of its kind in the U.S. or internationally?
No, but it is rare. So President Obama created the U.S. role in 2015, and at the time, it was the only position like it in the world. Since then, we've seen similar roles pop up in Argentina, the U.K., and Italy. But the U.S. position has actually been vacant since 2017 because President Trump never appointed anyone. Now, about 7 months into the job, I asked Special Envoy Stern where in the world she's seeing the most progress in terms of advancing LGBTQ rights and how the U.S. compares.
Progress is happening all around the world. I was thrilled that last year, decriminalization of homosexual status or conduct went into effect in Angola. Chile signed marriage equality into law, and Switzerland had a national referendum that permitted same-sex couples to adopt and use sperm banks. So every country's progress looks a little bit different. I would say that the U.S. is doing better than many, but we still have a long way to go on our road to progress. And I'll say one really exciting success from the U.S. over the past year was our change in U.S. passports. People applying for U.S. passports can self-declare whether they identify as male or female based on the concept of self-determination rather than requiring, for example, a medical certificate proving who they are. And the other really historic step forward was the addition of the X gender marker on U.S. passports.
And historically, do those steps, do they reverberate internationally? I mean, are you expecting more countries to take those steps now that the U.S. has?
Absolutely. I was just speaking with diplomats from Nepal, and they were, in essence, welcoming me to the club because Nepal has had such recognition for many years. When countries show leadership on these issues, it's infectious. And one of the examples we always use is Argentina's law on gender identity recognition, and a second is Malta's law on intersex rights. Mm. Both of those countries really created the pioneering law on trans and intersex rights, and they've become the gold standard that have been discussed by advocates and academics and governments many times over because they've shown us what can be done.
Special Envoy Stern, last month, the U.S. government released a report on the implementation of President Biden's memo, where he committed to the U.S. promoting LGBTQ rights abroad. And the report notes your appointment as major progress, plus the changes to the passports that we were speaking about earlier. I'm wondering, now looking ahead, what specific issues are you focusing on?
Top of mind for me is the need to decriminalize homosexual status or conduct in every country on the planet. Certainly the need to eliminate the death penalty as a punishment for homosexuality. The need to see legal gender recognition be the law of the land everywhere, and the ensuing sociocultural recognition.
And you've made it clear throughout your career and your time at the State Department that you see LGBTQ rights as an important pillar of U.S. foreign policy. Why is that framing important?
It's actually quite new for LGBTQI issues to be acknowledged as foreign policy priorities, not only for the U.S., really for any country around the world, but it's of paramount importance that LGBTQI issues are included because when I talk to LGBTQI advocates, they are often so profoundly isolated, and frankly, they're often so deeply under-resourced, and mainstream funding often doesn't reach them. And so LGBTQI plus rights have to be one of the top human rights concerns of the day. And I think that idea is catching on. More governments are taking note. Advocates have been saying this for a very long time, and now we just have to catch up with them and give them the resources and support they really deserve.
Speaking of resources, I want to ask you about the ongoing war in Ukraine. We know many Ukrainian refugees have fled into Hungary and Poland, both of which have cracked down on LGBTQ rights in recent years. What is the U.S. and your department doing to help keep queer Ukrainians safe?
The situation in Ukraine is dire for everyone. But that being said, I am in regular dialogue with LGBTQI plus Ukrainians directly because it's of paramount importance that I hear from them about the issues that they're experiencing. A case that is incredibly important is the case of Olena Shevchenko, one of the country's best known LGBTQI rights activists. She identifies as a lesbian. She's also a feminist. And she was recently on the street preparing to distribute emergency food and medical supplies to women and children that her organization serves when she was attacked with tear gas and who knows what other chemical agents. Wow. So I've been in direct contact to ensure that Olena is safe, and thankfully she is, but also to ensure that there's a police investigation into her attack and that the perpetrators will be held accountable.
When you are in touch with the people connected to Olena and other queer Ukrainians, are they surprised that you're reaching out to them directly?
I spent my career as a human rights defender, so I have pre-existing relationships with LGBTQI activists in Ukraine and all of the surrounding countries. So it's a huge asset, having a foundation of trust. I think they would be surprised if they didn't hear from me.
Jessica Stern, U.S. Special Envoy for International LGBTQI plus Rights. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Bianca.
That's The World's Bianca Hillier speaking with the State Department's Jessica Stern. Read and listen to more of Bianca's reporting on global LGBTQ issues on our website, theworld.org. When Ukraine was attacked, theaters and stages went dark. For ballet dancers, it meant no work, but one dance company has found temporary homes by touring Europe.
For a ballet dancer, it's not just about work. It's about your love, about your soul, about your spirit. It's like oxygen.
Romania one day, Italy the next. Coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Australians will go to the polls on Saturday. What a smart idea. Cast your ballot on a weekend so you don't have to squeeze it in before or after work. As The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports, that's just one reason why Australia's voting system is the envy of many.
If you live in the U.S., this has become your reality.
In Georgia this week, the sounds of American democracy still struggling.
New York's highest court says redistricting maps by Democrats violated the Constitution.
I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
My fellow Americans, our friends down under have a message for us. It doesn't have to be this way.
There's nothing that makes me more homesick than watching Australian elections.
This is James West. He grew up in Sydney, but he's been living in New York for the past 10 years.
The Australian electoral system is beautifully dull because everything basically works. Australians have the confidence that when they pop a ballot in the ballot box, it's going to get counted, it's going to be fair, and the will of the people is going to be represented in the result.
You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you.
So how is this possible? For starters, Wes says there's the Australian Electoral Commission.
A beautiful bureaucratic institution which operates national elections to exacting standards, and nobody ever complains about them.
The commission is a nonpartisan body. It runs elections in Australia in accordance with, wait for it, uniform electoral laws across all states. Okay, reason two Australian elections get high marks. Voter turnout is around 93%. 93%. And that's because Australia has compulsory voting. Judith Brett is a historian of Australian politics and a leading expert on compulsory voting.
None of the liberal democracies that Australia compares itself with, like the United States or the United Kingdom or Canada or New Zealand, have got compulsory voting.
In Australia, if you don't vote, you have to pay a $20 fine. You get sky-high voter turnout, but you also get a more chill campaign season. Brett says candidates don't have to go to extremes to rile up the base or stoke fear to get out the vote.
I mean, there's attempts at various times to message a little more to the right, but elections tend to be won or lost in the middle.
Voting in Australia isn't just mandatory. It's also fun.
It's a party atmosphere, so it's actually really nice.
Oh, look at that onion.
This is Thomas Shanahan. He lived in the U.S. for about 5 years, and now he's back home in Sydney. He says usually there's a big barbecue outside the school, church, or community center where voting takes place. And this brings me to the final reason why Australians just know how to do elections.
Now, we have something in Australia called the democracy sausage. You need to imagine a piece of white bread with a long, thin pork or beef sausage placed diagonally across the white bread and then covered in a sauce of your choosing.
It's the sausage of democracy, the symbol of our land, handed out at each election by a dedicated hand.
Is it called democracy sausage because it's like, this is how the sausage gets made, and then they're just taking that metaphor?
I wish I could say that it is called a democracy sausage because that's how the sausage is made. It's not. It's because it's what you buy on election day.
By the sausage of democracy, we stand.
Of course, Australia's electoral system has its problems. Polls show that most voters hate politicians. And weak campaign finance laws in Australia allow donors to hide their identities and their contributions. And yet, the Aussie system has a lot to recommend it, even if they do eat their hot dogs on a slice of bread instead of a bun. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Well, the two main parties standing, they're pretty much the same. Neither cares for the...
In many ways, the political situation in Libya has not settled down since the Arab Spring roiled the country in 2011. Yesterday, gunfire rocked Libya's capital, Tripoli. Rival militias clashed when a newly appointed prime minister tried to take control of Libya's government. More than a decade of political instability since longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown in 2011. Joining us now to talk about this latest chapter is Imaduddin Badi. He's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Middle East Initiatives and joins us from Toronto. Imad, who are the rival militias fighting in Tripoli and what happened in the clashes between them yesterday?
Well, this was essentially an attempt by Fateh Bashagha, the PM designated by the House of Representatives in eastern Libya in a rather contested vote. This was his attempt at almost introducing a fait accompli by arriving in Tripoli and announcing himself the new prime minister. This isn't the first time that Fateh Bashagha has attempted something like this. However, I would say that this is the first time within the context of him trying to oust the other prime minister, Abdelhamid Dbeibah, which was appointed last year.
But this newly appointed prime minister, Bashagha, he's supposed to be the man in charge. So why is he not being allowed to take power in Tripoli?
The alliance that brought Fateh Bashagha to the prime ministership is an alliance with a rather controversial set of figures, particularly for political stakeholders in Western Libya. So the figures that Bashagha have sought to ally himself with include Aguila Saleh, the controversial, I would say, chief of the parliament in Eastern Libya, and more importantly, Khalifa Haftar, the warlord who essentially controls a coalition of militias in Eastern Libya, and which 3 years ago launched an offensive on Tripoli and relapsed, I would say, Libya back into civil war and introduced also a new era of internationalization of the Libyan conflict.
So you're saying Bashagha may be the appointed prime minister, but he's kind of appointed fruit from a poison tree.
Absolutely, yes. At least that's the perception of a significant proportion of groups in Western Libya. And this is also the perception that kind of forced the events yesterday when that led to a conflict in the capital of Tripoli and forced the escape of Fateh Bashagha from Western Libya or from Tripoli.
Mm. So would you say these contours are really the main reason for Libya's inability to create a unity government more than a decade following the ouster of Gaddafi?
There are more, I would say, entrenched interests at the moment that thrive on the dysfunction, I would say, of the Libyan states. There's a vast array of armed groups that thrive on a war economy of sorts, on illicit economies, and that have a vested interest in not having a strong state in Libya. There are foreign powers as well that don't like the idea of Libya being a democracy and of a political roadmap that would culminate in elections. And there are also, more importantly, political stakeholders that have vastly different, I would say, ideologies in terms of what they would like the Libyan state to look like.
So elections were supposed to happen in Libya last year. They were delayed. Remind us why and what's happened politically since then to try and get those elections back on track.
I think we had somewhat of a poisoned roadmap, and I think the process was in and of itself very fragile. And sadly, there was a lot of effort put into matching the date of the suffrage rather than buttressing, I would say, the process towards election and the conditions that the vote would be held in. And that's part of the reason why the election plan didn't work out. The other facet is also the emergence of rather controversial candidates, which included the GNU, a government of national unity, Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeibah, which wasn't supposed to run based on a written pledge, Khalifa Haftar, who is suspected of being responsible for war crimes, and also the emergence of Saif al-Gaddafi, the son of former dictator Muammar Gaddafi, as a potential candidate. So I would say there's a mix of factors, some of which are more procedural, others which are more related to the controversy around the personalities.
So can you see a realistic scenario where there is a unity government in Libya in the next year?
Oh, there might be a unity government, but it would only be a unity government in name, much like the government from last year is only a unity government in name, and much like Fateh Bashagha's government is only a stability government in name. You really need a broader and more constructive process and roadmap that would be ideally milestone-based, and that would culminate in elections for things to stabilize. Sadly, I don't personally see the political capital being exerted to the extent to achieve that. At the moment, it's only being exerted to get a political deal, divvy up funds between these elites, and the electoral conversation or the impetus towards elections that we saw last year has ironically died down at the moment where it's most needed.
Emadeddin Abadi is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Middle East Initiative, speaking with us from Toronto. Emad, thank you very much.
Thank you, Markham.
Here's another way you can connect with news that gives you a global perspective. Each weekday, our digital editors curate a short list of top stories, plus features from the World Newsroom and a bit of good news to lighten your day. Subscribe to our morning newsletter at theworld.org. When Russian troops invaded Ukraine, the lights went out in Ukrainian theaters. That left dancers, artists, and musicians out of work. But one touring ballet company has given its dancers a new home over the past several weeks. The World's Carolyn Beeler met up with them at a show in Bucharest, Romania, over the weekend.
The performance of Giselle began like most other ballets. Stage lights down, audience quiet. Cue the music. But this story really started about a month into the war. That's when Ukrainian classical ballet artistic director Ivan Jaroblav was invited to organize a charity tour featuring Ukrainian refugees.
And in, I think, 5 days, I collect new company from whole Europe. You know, somebody was already in Spain, somebody in Italy, somebody in Germany.
After 4 days of rehearsals in Poland in early April, they launched a 12-show tour of Italy. A main goal, he says, is just to give dancers work.
Dancers who now have nothing, you know, because a lot of people from our art come out just with one suitcase. And it's a difficult situation.
Now, a second tour brings them to Bucharest. During a rehearsal, Jaroblav calls out steps from the front of the stage to dancers wearing warm-ups. Summer is low season for the ballet, so without a tour this spring, he says dancers would be out of work for at least 6 months. That would mean a financial hit and the longest break for many dancers since they were 5 years old.
For a ballet dancer, ballet, they take 90% of their brains, you know. And now that war canceled their professional life. It's too difficult. It's not just about work. It's about your love, about your soul, about your spirit, you know. That's why we are trying to make something for them, because it's like oxygen.
In Bucharest, the company runs through Giselle for tonight, and then Don Quixote, which they'll perform in Italy tomorrow. The two principal dancers practice a lift at the front edge of the stage. After the rehearsal, I speak with Daria Kostenko in front of her dressing room mirror. She used to dance at the Kyiv Municipal Theater, and when the war started, all she could think about was keeping her and her family alive. Now she's glad to be working. She needs the money.
It's really important because every artist, every dancer need to do classes every day because we lost our form, we lost our shape. When we rest about 3 days even.
Careers in ballet are competitive and short. If you want to stay in the profession, she says, you have to have somewhere to dance. But while she dances, Kostenko says it's hard to smile on stage while thinking about her family in Kharkiv, who she only hears from a couple times a month.
But these tours help us forget about this situation for a little bit times.
Dancer Marusia Hychuk also says it's hard to concentrate on stage, but dancing helps show how strong Ukrainians are.
If we stopped, Russia is a win. We must continue our lives, our culture again, because Russia has bombed our museums, our different important places, and we can't stop it.
Tears well up while we speak under her fake lashes. But soon she'll appear before the audience in a long, tiered dress, chin held theatrically high as she plays a noblewoman. As the audience starts to filter into the theater, Stella Fedorovich, who used to dance in Dnipro, says the tours helped her support her family financially and reassures them that she's safe.
Надежда есть в любом случае, а как будет, посмотрим.
She tells me she's hoping to dance in Ukraine next season. But what happens if she can't, I ask her. Will she leave her country behind to continue ballet?
It's a hard question. It's very hard. I don't know.
Ivan Zhuravlov, the artistic director, is from Bucha, a city where civilians have been slaughtered. I ask him backstage where he lives now.
Now? In Bucharest. Tonight. Tonight in Bucharest, tomorrow in Piacenza.
Their next show in Italy.
Next, I don't know. After each performance, we have opened some new possibilities. Who knows? Now it works like that.
During tonight's performance of Giselle, the dancers play mournful lovers and a grieving mother. But the staged emotions are no match for the real ones that come at the end of the show. When dancers unfurl a Ukrainian flag and sing along to the national anthem. The tears now are real. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Bucharest, Romania.
Right now, energy is under a bright spotlight. High gas prices, the war in Ukraine, and climate change are all focusing our attention on our energy future. We're working on a special edition of The World that's all about energy, and we would love your input. What are your biggest concerns and questions about energy? Email us a voice memo. The address is myworld@theworld.org. Let us know who you are and what's top of mind for you when you think about our energy future. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org. And listen for our special coverage later this month. The number is troubling, 100,000. That's how many people are on Mexico's National Registry of Disappeared and Missing Persons. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, called this a human tragedy of enormous proportions and urged Mexican authorities to do more. So what is to be done? Maria Luisa Aguilar Rodriguez is a human rights advocate with the Miguel Agustin Pro Juarez Human Rights Center in Mexico. Maria Luisa, 100,000 missing Mexicans. It is shocking. Who are these missing and disappeared in terms of gender and age?
So this is basically a tragedy that it's taking the very young generations in Mexico. 75% of the disappeared are males underage and up to 30 years old. 25% of the total are women. And regrettably, what we're seeing is an increasing of disappeared women in Mexico, girls, very young women up to 20 years old, who are increasingly disappearing in different parts of Mexico.
And as for the women, who are they?
In general, it's just very young women in different parts of Mexico. Their disappearances are related to cases of gender violence, cases of trafficking, or even just cases of how the violence in general in the country has been increasingly generalized and now reaching out also the women population.
I also know that part of the problem is the impunity of the perpetrators, but from what you know, who are they?
Yes. So to understand the disappearances, it's important to understand impunity in Mexico. In Mexico, around 90% of the crimes are not investigated. We only have around 2% of crimes actually solved. And so disappearances end up to be what the Committee on Enforced Disappearances of the UN called a perfect crime, because disappearances are not investigated, and that means that they are basically just perpetrated all these years. So the perpetrators could be state members, but also organized crime. But despite the fact that maybe a lot of these disappearances are committed by the organized crime, the state has a lot of responsibility in terms of the lack of searches, their consent on having a context where all these disappearances happen. So the responsibility in the state is very important to understand it in the larger context.
And when you say state member, are you referring to like the police in a particular Mexican state?
Yeah, I'm referring to the local police in many places of Mexico, but also the state police and even federal security forces in some cases.
The numbers of missing and disappeared in Mexico started skyrocketing in 2006 when Mexican authorities started going after drug cartels. So I'm wondering if that strategy increased the number of people who went missing.
Certainly. So around 97% of this whole figure of 100,000 people disappear occurred after 2006. So we really are talking about contemporary disappearances, and this is related to the security strategy. The security strategy since 2006 has been to deploy armed forces and federal forces into a lot of places in Mexico to combat the organized crime. This is something that hasn't reduced violence in Mexico, but it also has increased a lot of human rights violations.
I mean, in some parts of Mexico, parents are literally digging in the dirt to find the remains of their missing relatives. You've seen this firsthand. How has it come to that?
Definitely. In most of cases, there are mothers who have been digging on places just to search for their relatives. The crisis that is also related to the crisis of disappearances, the forensic crisis in Mexico. We have around 52,000 bodies that are recorded in Mexican institutions that haven't been identified. So there are 52,000 people who could be identified and returned to their families. Many of these bodies have actually been found because of the mother of the disappeared, because of their relatives who are searching by themselves without any help of the institutions. And actually, by doing this, pushing the institutions to do something about the crisis.
I mean, people are traumatized really for life when their loved ones go missing and never found. And yet I'm wondering how worried you are that Mexicans are becoming used to people disappearing and that somehow it's becoming normalized.
Given the dimension of the crisis, there is now this sense that disappearances are something that happened in Mexico without any explanation. And that's not true. There are many things that we have discussed around impunity and collusion of the state with organized crime that can explain it. But the families of the disappeared sometimes are still very stigmatized. And regrettably, many of them are
by themselves, still in a context of a lot of risks for denouncing the disappearances of their relatives. So many of the efforts that groups of relatives have been doing is trying to portray the image of their groups, but also of their relatives, to really try to touch the society. And that's why it's very important to give some idea of what is the pain and the suffering that all these families have been passing around of not knowing the whereabouts of their relatives.
Maria Luisa Aguilar Rodriguez is a human rights advocate with the Miguel Agustin Pro Juarez Human Rights Center in Mexico, speaking with us about the staggering number of 100,000 disappeared people there. Thank you very much, Maria Luisa.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Big news in cycling. Binyam Girmay of Eritrea became the first Black African to win a stage on one of the Grand Tours of bicycle racing. Yesterday, Girmay won the 10th day of the Giro d'Italia, the Tour of Italy, arguably the most important cycling event after the Tour de France.
Binyam Girmay, mature for Isaac for the moment, has to keep it going. And Veni, Vidi, Bini.
I came, I saw, Binyam Girmay conquered. This morning, Girmay went on camera and gave credit to his team, Intermarché, for doing most of the work in the peloton and pushing him up to the lead position.
I'm really happy about the team, what they did. Everybody, they are super motivation before the start, in the start, during the race, after the race. We really help each other. We support each other. So this victory is not only for me, for all the team. Congrats.
An historic day for Girmay and Black cyclists, only to be sadly punctuated just minutes later on the winner's podium, an accident that emergency rooms are well acquainted with on New Year's Eve. Girmay opened the celebratory bottle of bubbly, and the cork shot straight into his eye. Team doctors confirmed Girmay suffered a hemorrhage in his eye, and in that same video this morning, Girmay broke the unfortunate news to fans.
Today, luckily, I didn't start the race because still my eyes is, I need some rest to give more power in the eye. So yeah, just looking forward for the next season.
On the news in Eritrea, though, the good is still outweighing the bad. For Girmay, a champion this historic, the focus stays on the victory, not on the podium. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.